may have heard of genes that act selfishly, organisms that adapt in order to survive, ecosystems that behave as cohesive units. Biologists often talk about these things as though they were purposeful, exhibiting agency, directionality, or function. Should they? That's the big question that brings together the experimentalists, theoreticians, and philosophers involved in the Biological Purpose Project. This is the Purpose Podcast, where we will hear different interpretations of agency, directionality, and function, and how people use these interpretations to solve real-world problems and tackle long-standing questions in biology. Welcome to episode 5. I'm Siddharth. In this episode, we will be talking to Sharbel Elhani.
So I'm a full professor, history and philosophy of science in the Institute of Biology, Federal Universal Bahia.
The traditional view in science breaks down ecosystems into its constituent parts, which are organisms. And it assumes that the role of the organism, the way the organism evolves, is to fend for itself, it's adapted to survive in a given environment and maximize its reproductive offspring. That's evolutionary biology, right? But the way Sharbel thinks about it is slightly different.
So we usually classify, as you learn in high school, animals in ecological classes, predators, prey, decomposers. These are ecological functions. But these are ecological functions that we can call ecological functions activities, as Roberta Milstein proposes. And this is just population level evolution that produced this kind of functioning. But then we also take these functional roles, predator or consumers, and we put them in a trophic network, in a food network, which structures the ecosystem. And then these animals who are predator or prey, they're also playing a role in the flow of matter and energy in the ecosystem. So this is an ecosystem level function. They are contributing to a capacity of the ecosystem. So what we say, that's not, you don't need natural selection level of the ecosystem, but this kind of function, which is an extension of the ecological function that each population plays, because they are now part of a larger whole, which has this capacity of cycling nutrients and allowing a flow of matter and energy pass through it in a way that they decrease entropy. So that's another kind of function. We also have functions that ecological systems play in relation to socioeconomic systems, which we usually call ecosystem services. These functions are defined by the use of human beings. How human beings use resource in the ecosystem. They are not functions for the ecosystem. They are functions for us. So they are defined by our goals. So this is a kind of external function ascribed to an ecological process.
So there are three different ways of looking at the way ecosystems function. There's the stuff that organisms do for their own survival and maximize the numbers of their own species. There's a second kind, the things that organisms do for the continued existence of the ecosystem, for matter to continue to flow through the ecosystem. And then there's the way of looking at ecosystem functions that only serve human ends. And if it's not already obvious, the third one is kind of bad. And even though this seems kind of abstract, that second way of looking at ecosystem function, where organisms contribute to the flow of matter and energy through an ecosystem for its continued function, may be useful and beneficial not only to us, but to other organisms as well.
Because if we want really to understand how can we build better, more sustainable relations with ecological systems, we need to understand their dynamics. I can take an example of agroecosystems, for instance. This researcher just mentioned, Jefferson Coutinho, he works with agroecosystems. And his question is, how can an agroecosystem have a diverse landscape planning such that a number of ecological processes that are typically interrupted in the typical Green Revolution model farming can be maintained? So if you take the Green Revolution model farming, which is usually monoculture based on planting hundreds and thousands of kilometers of the same thing, this model is completely anti-ecological. It doesn't fit into the dynamics of ecosystems. And this creates problems. For instance, there are some insects. They are just normal insects. But they become pests for the agriculture. And the reason is, you plant one single crop and you take this insect that feeds on that crop. Then it immediately creates an immense amount of food for that insect, and you unbalance the population completely because they grow exponentially and they have a lot of food and they harm the agriculture. So if you understand ecological dynamics, you can do agriculture different. This is what the agroecological movement proposes. So if you take the agroecological movements, they try to understand the functions the components of the system plays in relation to the ecological process and try to mimic in the agroecosystem ecological process. So for instance, if you don't want pests, you just want regular insects. What you do is to plant a diversity of plants. And you, for instance, let's say you are planting ananas, and there are insects that are very fond of eating ananas. But you have other plants that these insects feeds much better on them. So we call this feeding selectivity. So you find a plant that the feeding selectivity of the insects much more for that plant that's not your plant of interest. And you plant this together with the ananas. It's true that you lose space where you could be planting ananas, but then you don't need chemical defensives because you have this plant. So this is making our farming system, which is one of the highest problems ecologically in our planet today. So our agribusiness is destroying everything. And we start to make this with forests. You don't plant fields of soy, you plant forests. And if you plant forests, you make better agriculture in terms of sustainability. It can be productive because there are research showing productivity, but also productivity is not the only measure for the success of the system, because you look at productivity, you look at food security, you're looking at the organization of the rural communities, you're looking at biodiversity. And this is because you understand how the ecosystem works and you try to first mimic the ecosystem dynamics into your agroecosystem and also make an agroecosystem that contributes at a landscape level with the natural ecosystems around, because you need a natural ecosystem. So for instance, if you have bees, which are important pollinators of your cultures, your crops, many times these bees, they nest in native ecosystems. So you need to have native ecosystems close to the crops, because that's where the bees will reproduce. And without the bees, you don't have pollination. So there is a study in my state, people who plant passion fruit, and they had a decline in pollination. It cost them millions of dollars of loss. And that's because they start planting passion fruit. And the bees they need to pollinate the passion fruit, they live in the semi-arid environment around, but now they are kilometers apart, so they cannot pollinate. And the solution they do is to bring beehives, which is costly and creates an ecological problem, when they could do much better if they understand the landscape dynamics, because they plant passion fruit in between the forest patches where the bees, the native bees that they don't need to pay for them, they're just there. They would be there to pollinate the passion fruit. So I think to understand ecosystem is a crucial for us to have a more sustainable mode of relation with human, with a natural systems. Because if you don't understand these systems, it's a game of chance, yeah, that we can be sustainable.
Charbel is not a philosopher in the classical mold. He works with large teams spread across the world, and he also works with indigenous and peasant communities on cultural exchange of ideas that feed back into his philosophy.
I know you also work with a lot of indigenous and peasant communities. Can you talk about the importance of you know, those kinds of interactions for building?
That's a great question, Sidham, because we have two lines of research in the lab. One is these on ecological functions. The order is an intercultural relations between knowledge systems. And you touch exactly where the two combine. Because indigenous communities and local communities too, they usually have a wealth of knowledge about ecosystem dynamics. Their lives depend on that. And if you look at their knowledge, and we are more humble. So you work, for instance, with an ethic virtue that comes from a feminist thinker from India called Vrinda Dalmia. It's a relational humility. I mean, it's a very complex virtue. It's the virtue that you self-ascribe to you ignorance, and you ascribe knowledge to others. And then this is part of our training of our students, that usually academics are very arrogant people. And usually when they are ignorant, they think they can solve themselves, the ignorance, or at most they'll look at scientific knowledge to solve ignorance. But we go beyond that. So we say there are things we don't know, and there are things other communities know which are not academics, and we can learn with them if you start building intercultural relations. It's run by Paris Boletin, who is an anthropologist from the Czech Republic, and myself.
And the way Charbel works with these communities is not, he doesn't study them like an outsider. It's a collaboration.
Because you go to work in a community, they are trying to understand you. They are doing an anthropology of you researchers, of us researchers, while we are doing an anthropology of them. So it's a game of mirrors. And we are trying to make this into a method. Then we went, in fact, I didn't go because I got COVID 2 days before the trip. But one of our doctoral students, Julia Turska, and Paris, they went to work with the one indigenous tribe in the one Amerindian tribe in the Amazon called the Mebegokre, with whom Paris works for 22 years now. And I began working much earlier, much more recently with them. And we talked to them about several narratives while planting with them or hunting with them. And we collected several stories that have to do with ecological functions. They tell us that the Agouti is a farmer, while the Macau is not a farmer. And why they say this? Because the Agouti, they plant the Brazil nut seeds, while the Macau, they destroy the Brazil nut seeds. But interestingly enough, the Agouti is a farmer of Brazil nuts, but of a manio, a cassava. It is not a farmer. It steals cassava because they don't do anything about cassava. If you translate this into our theory, what we would say is the Agouti has the ecological function of being a granivore, just as the Macau. But the Macau doesn't play the ecosystem level function of contributing to the germination of trees, which are quite central to the composition structure of the Amazon forest, like the Brazil nut. While the Macau doesn't play this ecosystem function. So that's why the Agouti is a farmer.
The Agouti is a genus of many species of rodent that's found in Central and South America. And according to Charbel's conception, the Agouti serve the ecosystem function of being a gardener. So their contribution to the ecosystem is to continue to maintain the ecosystem, which is the contribution of every organism within that ecosystem. And his work is trying to figure out how we can understand the contributions of all organisms within an ecosystem in maintaining that ecosystem, not simply in maintaining itself. And the work that he does with these indigenous communities on cultural exchange takes him quite far from home. It's a really long journey.
It's very hard to reach there. It's as expensive as going to Europe. We take a plane from Salvador and we fly like 3.5 hours to one of two cities, either a city called Altamira or a city called Marabá, depends on the price of their flight. And then they have to take us there. So the indigenous people, they come with the cars and they take us there, and it takes like 12 hours by land to reach their indigenous land, 12 hours by land. Or if you go by boat, which is very pleasant, but they have a very organized society. So we do something that we call mutirão, is a word in Portuguese for doing things everybody together. So we do research in a way that we try to work with the whole group, with like 300 people. So there are meetings where they meet in their ceremonial place, and all of them are there. And then they participate. But we have two people who are the representatives, Bepkoi Xikrin and Katoprori Xikrin. And they talk with us all the time. So while we are not there, they are doing things. And they sign the papers with us. So for instance, with the Agouti paper, we have now a first draft. And Paris is sending through WhatsApp the argument to them. Because no point to send a Word document for them to. They will not do that. And then we record the arguments, and then they record back saying that's correct, that's incorrect, this should change here. And sometimes there is more information that is needed. Then they get the information.
Now, see, a lot of people work with indigenous communities, with local people to get information on the local biodiversity. They have them as guides to take them through forests. They usually pay them as well. But given the level of intellectual exchange between these communities and Charbel, I had to ask whether they get authorship. And this is what he said.
Usually they are the first helpers. It's their knowledge.
This is a very unusual way of doing science or doing philosophy. Not only does it challenge a lot of academic orthodoxy, it's also a lot of work. So why go through all this?
We can learn by being challenged by the other to think the unthinkable, what you are not thinking.
Instead of seeing their worldview as imaginary or mythical or simply sort of quaint and interesting, Charbel actually sees intellectual value in this. He thinks there's something we, as in the rest of the world, can learn from this.
The mode of human nature relations we build is based on the relational value of using, utilization, which means that we are limited to talk about natural resources and rational use of natural resources. And all our talk about sustainability is about that. And let's be frank, we are not very good at that, because we are not getting any better. We talk about sustainable development since 1987. This concept is a complete failure. It generated a lot of development, much less sustainability. So we are failing as a society. And if you look at the Amerindian people, now we know that a significant part of the Amazon forest is not a pristine environment like is described for people. It's a domesticated environment in several places, where we can see that hotspots of biodiversity in the Amazon, they map with the places where the Amerindians were living, where they were capable of increasing the fertility of the land, of the soil, up to 1,000%, and create something we call the dark earths, the dark lands of indigenous people, which map to hotspots of biodiversity of the forest today. So these people were living in the forest. We know now from the archaeological record, new data, there are even cities inside the Amazon with 100,000 people living there. And they are not doing what we are doing. The forest is there. They live in the forest is standing. And they don't have a mode of utilization, of use. This concept doesn't mean anything for them, sustainability, rationality in the use of natural resources doesn't make a sense. Because they have an idea about nature that Europeans called anthropomorphism, animism, and there are bad words like saying they are primitive people. Instead of just saying they are saying things we don't believe, we should open up our ears and say, well, what we can learn from that? The first thing we can learn is if some people think everything is human. They don't use the word human, they use the word peoples. Everything in nature is a people. So an agouti is a people. The agouts are people because they are the center of their ontology. They are in the center of their world. The jaguars are peoples because they are the center of their world. And we are people because we are the center of our world. And then what this means is that every being is a social being too. And so we should be careful. We should be careful to deal with nature, with animals, plants, as careful as we are to deal with another human being. And this is why they build a model that people in conservation is called the ritualized mode of relation with nature. Is ritualized because we humans, we ritualize the relations between ourselves. So they ritualize everything. And that's one basic reason why they can live with the natural system much better than we. And this has all to do with natural norms. Because if every being in the world is a people, all of them have their norms. And we need to negotiate norms all the time. You have to negotiate norms. And so you cannot simply go there, I could hunt one agouti, I will hunt 100. No, you can't do that. You have to obey the rules, the norms. So I think this idea of natural norms, which science usually rejects, can be very important to build another way of relating with nature that we deeply need. And it doesn't matter if it comes from science or not, in fact.
And the norms are that for ecosystems to survive, every organism that lives in that ecosystem has to serve a function that supports the continued existence of that ecosystem, even if that organism thinks it is separate from the ecosystem.
We interfere with the ecosystems with our goals, our social goals. And by doing this, if we don't do what the indigenous people do, we don't negotiate our norms with the natural norms of the ecosystem. When we don't do this, we create problems for the dynamics of the ecosystem. You can say, for instance, fire in a savanna ecosystem is integrated with the dynamics of the system. So when a savanna gets fire, there's no problem, because this will be important for the savanna effect. But we go and build a lot of cities in between the savanna houses, then what you do? We add more fuel, because the savanna has its fuel to take fire. It's the plant-adapted species who are flammable. But then you have houses, then you have a gas station, then we increase the magnitude of the fire. And this fire can go beyond the threshold that the natural norms of the system can handle. And that's when the fire becomes a destructive for an ecosystem that always lived with fire. There was never problem fire, but we had problems because we are fulfilling our goals. We can fulfill our goals because we need, but if we pay more attention to the goals of the natural system and negotiate better, then we can really be more sustainable. If we don't do this, sustainability is a cheap dream.
So what do we do about it? Can we do anything about it?
We are using 2.5 Earths per year of resources. So how can we develop? We cannot develop. We need to move back. Because we cannot use not even one Earth resource, because there are other beings on Earth. So the idea of developing sustainably is like you earn $10,000 per month, but you want to live on $20,000, and you think this will work. We know this will not work. So we know in our house this does not work. So it's amazing how, in planetary terms, we think this works. But it's because the alternative is quite serious. The alternative is that we change completely our mode of political and economic organization, because the only way we can do that is by distributing income globally, so that people who are starving can have things to eat. Because, for instance, me in Brazil, as a middle-class guy, or many Americans, we are living 4 or 5 times better than we need, and we need now to share with the rest of the world for the poor to be able to eat. Well, but that's the end of the modern state, yeah? So we are thinking about a quite radical political reorganization.
I know what you're thinking. This all sounds a bit too radical. It's too unrealistic. Well, Charbel knows.
It would be a little difficult. So think about the next election. The next election in the US or in Brazil, the candidate for the president, and he says, well, we need to decrease the way of live, the quality of life of the Americans or the Brazilian, because you need to help people in Africa who are starving. It's been very unlikely to win the election. So with modern states, we cannot really do that. We need some kind of global civilization, which we really don't have. And perhaps we create a problem we cannot solve. Because no, Marx once wrote that humans create problems that they can solve. I think he wasn't wrong.
That is a really dire note to end on. And you may be thinking that of course there are solutions. We will switch to renewable energy. We will recycle. We can change our ways. If each of us just does their bit, we can get through this. I'm going to leave a video in the description that I think does a good job of explaining why each of us doing our bit might never be enough. And as for those energy transition goals, there are several reports that have been coming out that say that we're far behind the goals we set out for ourselves. I wish I had something reassuring to say, but I don't. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it's okay to face the full reality of existential dread and not have an easy answer to sugarcoat it with. That's all from this episode of the Purpose Podcast. The Purpose Podcast is brought to you by the Biological Purpose Project, funded by the John Templeton Foundation. To learn more about the Biological Purpose Project, you can visit biologicalpurpose.org. Thank you for listening.
So if humans do not contribute to the functioning of ecosystems, ecosystems will collapse. Is that the